was a product largely of the post-classical period itself. Finally, significant statement number three, even for those regions that did not directly convert to Islam, the power of the Arabs and the power of Islam inevitably compelled attention. China, for example, while not confronted with a direct Islamic surge through the society as a whole, different, for example, from Buddhism in this regard, nevertheless encountered the Arabs and certainly encountered Islam in the Western provinces, and a new Islamic minority developed in China that, again, remains important to the present day. Russia, although not in this period Islamic, was quite aware of the importance of Islam, and the Russian ruler Vladimir, when he converted to Christianity around 1000 CE, presumably decided directly against Islam because, as he put it, the Rus enjoy their drink. Islam, in other words, didn't quite make it for this early Russian ruler because of its aversion to alcohol. But the consciousness was there, and obviously later on, Russia would develop a much more complicated relationship with Islam and with Muslims. Western Europe encountered Islam quite directly as the Islamic invasions poured into Spain and at some points also held portions of Sicily. And the West was also extremely conscious of Islam through the post-classical period and beyond, both as a source of inspiration, a model for imitation in some respects, but also clearly as a source of dread. The fact that Western Christianity developed in a period in which Islam was clearly more powerful and more intimidating helped shape a set of Western attitudes that, again, echo to this day at least to some degree. Islam, as no other of the world religions did in this period, touched literally every society, directly or indirectly, during the post-classical period itself. This is a major story. Equally obviously, there are some complexities in dealing with Islam of three sorts. First, Islam encounters all sorts of issues in the contemporary world because of Islamic participation in terrorism, other issues that help create difficulties and biases in interpreting Islam, and we just need to acknowledge this at the outset. Second, as I already briefly mentioned, not just contemporary Westerners, but Westerners over a long period of time have harbored prejudices against Islam, hostilities to Islam, which have led to certain kinds of perceptions that are quite old, and if not outright distortions, at least significant exaggerations and oversimplifications, and we need to try to sidestep these as well, but it's not always easy. And finally, the particularly important point, Islam has long been varied. This is a major religion covering vast territories with all sorts of variations, not only the famous Shiite-Sunni split, but all sorts of variations in encounters with social issues, with political issues, with concepts such as jihad. And it's very important to recognize that just as with Christianity, where we would seriously hesitate to say this is the Christian way, with Islam, the complexity is important, but frankly, sometimes easier to forget. So we'll take a stab today at talking about the rise of Islam in the post-classical period, and also some of the interpretation issues that affect our judgment of what Islam did then, and to some extent, what its legacy was for later periods as well. The first issue, interestingly, involves recognizing the combined but complicated relationship of the Arab military and commercial surge after 600 and the simultaneous Arab conversion to Islam. In the vacuum of power left in the Mediterranean world, particularly the Middle East and North Africa, in the wake of the fall of the Roman Empire, Arab leaders obviously saw an opportunity to expand their military efforts to seize plunder, to seize new territories, to gain wealth and political power, and they did this. They also became Muslim in the main, and their advance would help spread Islam, again, particularly in the Middle East and in North Africa and on into Spain for several centuries. Most scholars now argue that the Arab surge needs to be taken as one of those periodic explosions of a people interested in new opportunities, rather than a sign of Islam's spur to conquest and conversion. Islam would, as I mentioned in a previous comment, Islam would long be somewhat hesitant to try to convert non-Arab peoples. The Arabs were not initially primarily interested in spreading Islam to those other peoples. We need to sort things out a little bit. But the first basic fact remains uncontested, nevertheless. The Arab world expanded, Islam grew with it, and this provided a crucial homeland for both the Arabs and Islam in the post-classical period, and this happened quite quickly on the footsteps of the Arab armies. Islam would also spread during the post-classical period to a large number of other regions, though each articulation deserves a little bit of special attention. Islam spread to India involved primarily efforts by missionaries and merchants, but Arab or Muslim armies periodically poured into India during the post-classical period in Africa, sometimes seeking brief opportunities for plunder, sometimes setting up somewhat larger political units like the Delhi Sultanate that was established in the post-classical period itself. Islam never displaced Hinduism as India's majority religion, but a combination of missionary activity, example, and direct political pressure did help create substantial Muslim minorities in key parts of India, beginning in the post-classical period, though the process would expand later on. Islam also penetrated Central Asia, often displacing Buddhism in the process. Here, conversions to Islam frequently brought nomadic peoples to a major world religion in advance of later movements into the Middle East. For example, the Turkish people converted to Islam in Central Asia, often to very fervent and pious versions of Islam. And then when they would move into the Middle East later on, in the post-classical period and beyond, they would bring this faith with them as part of their political and cultural impact. The hold of Islam in Central Asia was not absolutely uniform, but there's no question that a substantial inroad was made. Islam's penetration in sub-Saharan Africa was yet a third case. Here, Islam certainly described a mixed Arab-African community that developed along the Indian Ocean coast, the Swahili community that developed, among other things, a language that utilized a mixture of Arab and African forms. And this was a coastal zone that was pretty solidly Muslim. But in the West African kingdoms, the kingdoms of Ghana and Mali and others, Islam became a significant minority faith, but mainly among the upper classes. African rulers used it as a source of bureaucracy, as a source of writing, and there were some undeniably fervent conversions to the Islamic faith, but most of the rulers made little effort to press ordinary people to convert, and for many centuries Islam remained a major religious force, but not a majority religious force, in this part of the world. Finally, of course, as mentioned before, Islam gradually spread to Southeast Asia, to the continent, particularly places like Malaysia, and to the islands of present-day Indonesia, where it would ultimately gain a very substantial hold indeed. The expansion of Islam and the particular phases in each given region can also be usefully divided between areas in which Islam expanded on the heels of military activity and political rule, and where Islam expanded much more purely on the basis of missionary and commercial outreach. Africa is mainly missionary and commercial, but there were a few periodic military raids from North Africa into West Africa that muddy the process a little bit. Military and missionary activity combined is noted in India. The spread to Southeast Asia, however, had nothing to do with military pressure whatsoever. This is then not a totally simple division, but a useful one, and certainly a useful reminder that Islam spread widely with no implications of military pressure or political overlordship at all. Why was the religion so successful? As we've noted in talking about the world religions generally, there's no simple answer to this. Certainly, many people would point to the clarity of Islam, to the extent to which Islam developed codes of conduct, that while demanding, because remember, man was sinful and needed to be held to exacting standards, while demanding, at least pointed rather clearly to the major obligations that a person could fulfill in order to gain religious reward in the afterlife. This legal clarity on the part of Islam could be attractive. And Islam had and certainly added, particularly with the rise of the Sufi movement from the 8th century onward, Islam had powerful claims on personal piety, on spiritual enthusiasm, on religious emotion. It was a very impressive religious package in its own right. Islam also gained ground, as we noted, for the world religions generally, but it was particularly true for Islam in this period. Islam also gained ground simply because of the example of Arab and Muslim commercial and political and military success. Again, without detracting from the religion, many people were undoubtedly drawn to it, even if they added true pious commitments, because it was attached to such clear success in the post-classical world, in the Middle East, North Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, in other places as well. Islam also gained because of an interesting combination of tolerance and inducement. There were episodes in the post-classical period in which Muslims turned quite intolerant against other religions. Jews and Christians were in principle people of the book, their religious traditions a precursor of religious truth and therefore to be respected, and for the most part they were. But Jews and Christians were also subject to distinctive taxation policies, even as their political communities were allowed to continue to exist. And there certainly were some fiscal reasons, some reasons of political acceptance to think about conversion in this framework as well. Relatively few people were actually forced to convert to Islam. The concept of jihad, which is usually interpreted as an effort to defend Islam militarily or, more abstractly, as a personal struggle to live a pious life against impulses toward sin, jihad was rarely employed as a direct effort to push people into conversion, but a framework of political activity in which there were some inequalities for non-Muslims certainly could prove influential. Certain social groups might see some particular motivation in converting to Islam. Of all the major religions, Islam is undoubtedly the most tolerant of merchant activity. It does not condone anything a merchant might do. It stipulates, for example, that the taking of interest, usury, is literally wrong. But Muhammad himself had been a merchant. He praised the merchant life, and so long as a merchant combined his commercial activity with appropriate fulfillment of religious obligations, merchant activity was by itself fine. So merchants might be attracted to Islam in societies beyond the Arab world. Ordinary people, poor people, might find in Islam obviously a source of religious solace, a hope for benefits in the afterlife in heaven, but they could also see in Islam a powerful statement of spiritual equality and a clear opportunity for access to charity. All the major world religions enjoin charity, but Islam does so particularly clearly as one of the five major obligations, and a charitable atmosphere could help frame the popularity of Islam as well. Even slaves, as we'll discuss a little later, might find some specific advantages in Islam. The motivations, in other words, were varied and help explain the undoubted fact this was a very popular religion indeed. Complexities in the spread of Islam clearly involve the famous split that occurred relatively soon after Muhammad's death between Shiites who were attached to a son-in-law of Muhammad as caliph and the majority Sunnis who held to a different selection for caliph, and the two groups would differ over other patterns of religious interpretation. They would differ in their claims to purity, etc., this rift began early and obviously continues to define the Muslim world, not always surfacing in acute tension, but reminding us that this was a faith that could have a number of branches, did have a number of branches. The emergence of Sufism, while certainly supporting Muslim missionary efforts, the religious enthusiasm the Sufis generated was considerable, could create another kind of tension between a more emotional version of Islam and a more, one might say, cerebral or rational approach. Divisions of various sorts entered early and would continue to mark, understandably, the progress of a major but complicated religion. Muslims in the post-classical world, particularly Muslim cultural figures, face some interesting tensions between the injunctions of the faith and the rich artistic heritage of the Middle East, including its Hellenistic heritage. So during the post-classical period itself, during the heyday of Arab and Islamic development in the Middle East, some really interesting discussions and compromises occurred between people eager to embrace their Islamic faith, but eager also to share in the artistic, scientific, and philosophical traditions of the region. Islam, Muhammad enjoined against, for example, the artistic representation of animal or human figures, because these would be potential sources of idolatry. And in the Arab world, this injunction was largely upheld during the post-classical period and beyond. But as Islam spread to Persia, the Persian artistic tradition, which had a richer experience with human and animal representation, could shade off and maintain that earlier emphasis alongside a more literal adhesion to the faith. Islamic attitudes toward music were complicated. The Middle East, in fact, developed or furthered a rich musical tradition, although the religion itself advised against the use of music, again, because of its potential distraction from purer spirituality. A great deal of philosophical effort in the post-classical world went into discussions of the relationship between Islamic faith and rational science and philosophy. The Arab world generated, building on Greek and Hellenistic traditions, the Arab world generated important scientific and medical discoveries. This is one of the science centers of the post-classical world. But people also talked about how much truth could one gain by use of reason alone. Where did faith have to come in because reason couldn't penetrate? This was a philosophical tradition that would later inform Christianity as well. And the Arab advance here was quite sophisticated and quite impressive. The question then of the role of religion in a rich cultural combination was a crucial one during the height of the post-classical period in Islamic centers, not just in the Middle East proper, but in other centers of scholarship, for example, in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. The role of the state of Islam in Islam was a crucial one. Two points are pretty clear. First, the religion itself had a clear model of an ideal ruler. This ruler would uphold the laws and obligations of religion as first duty. He would himself be pious and faithful. But beyond that, he would use the state not just to defend the religion, but to advance it, to associate its laws and rules with the laws of the state itself, to punish on behalf of the religion, etc. So there was an image of the ideal ruler or imam or caliph that was a very important product of Muhammad's own writings and those of the traditions that build on the Quran in subsequent years and centuries. But second point, the actual Arab caliphate, the rule that was established after Muhammad, first in Damascus and then in Baghdad, the actual Arab caliphate, although it used religious nomenclature and claimed the Islamic mantle, was rarely primarily religiously inspired. There were individually pious caliphs, people who could be used as examples of spirituality or charity, but most caliphs were pretty worldly. The court around the caliphs was increasingly luxurious. This was not, in fact, an example of the religious ideals that Islam seemed to embrace. So, two initial facts. There's a model, and there's the actual historical practice that differs widely from the model. So what do we put in between? Several points. First of all, like Christianity, but perhaps a bit more forcefully, the Quran urged that even when the state was inappropriately organized, even when it was unjust, the loyal Muslim should remain loyal to it because becoming embroiled in political disputes would distract one from religious obligation. In other words, Muslims were enjoined to accept political injustice, to accept rule that did not correspond to the ideals, because political chaos would be inimical to religious purpose. So the loyalty injunction was quite clear. But there was also always the possibility that Muslims might periodically measure the state against the greater expectations of religious purpose and religious justice and come to a different kind of conclusion, a tension that was built into Islam, just as in many ways it's built into Christianity, where Christians are enjoined normally to accept the rule of the state because that's not the primary sphere of religion, but can try to see occasionally Christian values as ones that can be used to reshape or protest the state itself. Much ink has been spilled in the contemporary world over the political traditions of Islam and their relationship to modern democracy. The debate is possibly a bit sterile because original Islam had little connection with any possibility of democracy, any more than early Christianity, except perhaps for very early Christianity, did either. This is just not a relevant part of assessing these religions in a post-classical context where democracy was simply absent. One crucial difference between Islam and Christianity can be noted, though what to make of it is not entirely easy. Christianity was born outside the state. The Roman state did not always persecute Christians. Persecution was sporadic, but it certainly was not a friendly force for over three centuries. In Islam, because of Muhammad's position as political and religious leader, and then the subsequent traditions that went into the caliphate, the religion was born in association with the state and could be seen more clearly then as an instrument of politics, as something where the state should be actively engaged. At the same time, lest we press this distinction between Islam and Christianity too far, Islam was also forced to develop a structure that would allow it to endure even amid state indifference, if not sometimes outright hostility. So while Islam did not establish quite such a clear institutional church as did Catholics in Western Europe, Islam established networks of scholarly centers where Islamic scholarship and law could be interpreted that helped sustain and provide some coherence in Islam, even amid political indifference, even amid the vast expansion of Islam across such a large territory. So centers of Islamic legal scholarship in places like Cairo, Egypt, became unifying points, not quite in such an institutional way as in the Christian church, but through the power of persuasion, through the power of intellectual authority. And this helps explain why Islam could exist in a variety of political circumstances, both in the post-classical period and subsequently. Islam clearly had important social implications that provide a specific illustration of some of the larger points about the world religions and society that we made in the previous discussion. Two areas, I think, command particular attention. The first is the relationship between Islam and slavery, and the second, inevitable and I think actually quite interesting, the position of Islam on issues of gender. With regard to slavery, Islam was concerned about slavery, but equally obviously tolerated it. Middle Eastern society had a significant number of slaves, some of whom were imported from Europe and Africa. Large numbers of slaves were part of the African trade with the Middle East. And yet Islam was not entirely comfortable with slavery, particularly when the slave was himself or herself Muslim or converted to Islam. So while Islam tolerated slavery more readily than Christianity did, although there was complexity in European Christianity as well, even before the great African slave trade, while Islam tolerated slavery, it tended to provide also some protections, particularly for Muslim slaves. Families were rarely separated. Muslim slaves gained superior work conditions. They might frequently be manumitted, even when they had been imported from Africa. This was an area of ambivalence where issues of belief, including belief in the equality of souls for believers, clashed with social reality in ways that were not entirely tidy. Muhammad unquestionably believed, and I see no reason to contest this, that he was bringing improvements to conditions of women as he spread this religion among the Arabs. Several injunctions are particularly noteworthy. In the first place, the Quran specifically inveighs against female infanticide, and indeed, the spread of the world religions generally helped reduce infanticide throughout much of the Afro-Eurasian landmass. Female infanticide was wrong because females had souls. Babies should not be deliberately killed. Women were given clear legal rights in Islam. Most important, in contrast to situations in much of Christianity, Muslim women had property rights. They could own property. They had claims to their dowries. They had claims to parts of family inheritance. These rights were not necessarily equal to those of men, but they were well established, and they gave Muslim women important opportunities, not just in property possession, but in business activities. Muslim women also had rights with regard to divorce, unequal to those of men, but definite. They had access to worship, although separate from men. They had important access to travel, and historians have actually debated the opportunities for women in Muslim travel, particularly the great pilgrimage to Mecca, compared to opportunities for travel by Christian women in the same period. And the conclusion is Muslim women had considerably more latitude in this area. At the same time, 2 points. First, Islam protected women in many respects. It advanced women's spiritual interests, but it did not provide equality. Contemporary Muslims can argue, do argue, that the system could be perfected to correspond more fully with contemporary standards, but there's no question that if you look at Islam literally in the post-classical period, women have some stipulated inferiorities vis-a-vis men in marriage and religion alike. Second, in the Middle East, Islam became overlaid with acceptance of other regional traditions, notably the practice of veiling, which is not directly enjoined in the religious literature itself. Muhammad urged veils for some of his own family, possibly so they would not be harassed in public. But a general religious obligation of veiling was not clearly present. It was added in regional perceptions as the religion integrated more fully with Middle Eastern urban society, where veiling had been established earlier. The issue is obviously then complicated, and one just needs to leave it at that. This is not a clear-cut victory for gender equality, but it's arguably a significant advance. It arguably can be utilized. Even in contemporary society, the debate clearly continues. Arab society declined in some measurable ways by the 13th century. The caliphate became less effective. Various territories in North Africa and Spain peeled off, even aside from the